Thank you. What a pleasure to be in Berlin, to be part of a series on democracy, worried about democracy, thinking about democracy, to be hosted by Blätter, to have been invited in the first place, and then hosted beautifully by Daniel. I just thank you. It's a genuine honor to be here, and I hope I can do justice to the honor. We also had an extraordinary conversation among the various discussants and myself just before, and I'm very excited for that conversation, so I'll try not to rush through what I have to say to get to it, but I think the differences between the European situation and the U.S. will also be fascinating to us all. I want to bracket the chaos and the calamity, the horror and even some of the hilarity of the Trump regime, to ask this. How was this openly plutocratic government for the rich and authoritarian power brought into being from a popular base that stands to gain so little from it? As many have noted, all Trump voters did not and do not line up with everything he says and is any more than all Clinton voters, this one for example, lined up with her corporate cronyism, neoliberalism, militarism, and political opportunism. Some Trump voters were mad about the cost of their health care, their lost jobs, their declining communities and standards of living. Some were ardent, unqualified supporters of Israel, and that was their most passionate cause. Some longed for a time before the challenges of globalization and climate change, and they basked in his promise to vanquish both by fiat. Some hoped that a Trump presidency would better their prospects as business owners, investors, or workers, and it's important to remember that tax cuts have been at the top of the conservative agenda for more than 30 years. During the campaign, Trump spoke more often about cutting taxes than he did about bombing ISIS, or building a wall, or banning Muslims. Some evangelicals and Catholics voted only on abortion, while objecting to much else about Trump. Some voted for the Republican candidate because they always have. Some recoiled from Hillary and were fortified in this, of course, by right-wing news sites and bloggers. Some on the alt-right, some Ku Klux Klanners, some Nazis, we have them all in the U.S., voted for the first time in over 40 years, not because he was exactly their guy, but because he threw them more bait than any viable candidate had since George Wallace, the 1966 segregationist. And some, already politically fearful, were recruited by Trump's fear-mongering. It's important to remember, as we start to diagnose how we came to this pass, that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were two of the most disliked presidential candidates in American history, and even the 50% of eligible voters who did make it to the polls did a lot of nose-holding. All this said, who voted for Trump? I'm going to sound like a political scientist for just a second. 88% of his support was white. This included two-thirds of white voters without a college degree, over half of white female voters, two-thirds of white male voters, and three-quarters of white voters over the age of 50. Trump did get more Latino votes and votes from the well-off and college-educated than most had expected, but his mass support came from working and lower middle class, 35 and older, uneducated whites, especially white men. This in a country that is now around 60% white in its citizenship. So this white mass support from working and lower middle class, 35 and older, uneducated whites, remains Trump's base. Moreover, of Trump voters, nearly 25% interviewed in exit polls said they didn't think he was qualified for the presidency and that Clinton was, but they voted for him. We need to figure this out. Together, what these figures suggest is that we're not dealing mainly with the politically abandoned working and lower middle class. We are dealing with dethroned whites, especially white men, who have lost not just economic but social power and pride of place in the conjuncture of four historical developments. First, Four decades of neoliberal policies and practices that have gutted wages, benefits, pensions, job security, infrastructure, and easy access to higher education, hence any kind of social mobility, among the working and lower middle classes. Second, three decades of financialization, that is, the shift of an economic engine to financial markets, that exacerbated the redistribution upwards of wealth, including a real estate-driven financial crisis that took very heavy casualties in the group that supported Trump through foreclosures and savings meltdowns. Third, globalization that transformed both the economies and the populations of the global north, draining them of large-scale industry and of whiteness. And finally, a perceived liberal political agenda understood by Trump voters to promote historically excluded groups, women, racial and sexual minorities, the disabled, new immigrants, and above all, African Americans. Two-thirds of Trump supporters believe that whites are not getting what they deserve, while blacks are getting more than they deserve. In fact, African Americans as a population, both urban and rural, have suffered far greater declines than whites since the 1970s. Unemployment, underemployment, and rising housing costs, the decline of union jobs, diminished public services and educational funding, skyrocketing incarceration rates, all of these have combined to lower the standard of living and devastate black neighborhoods far more than is the case for whites. But this decline and this devastation constitutes a broken promise. It is not the stuff of raging resentment at lost entitlement and pride of place. It is the material of Black Lives Matter, one of the most important social movements in the US in decades, but that's another talk. Now, did all of these white people who voted for Trump blame minorities and immigrants for their own felt deprivations or those of the nation? No, but obviously the Trump campaign facilitated that displacement, taking a page from Nietzsche on ressentiment and Freud on narcissistic wounds, where one seeks an object, any object, on which to displace one's humiliation or suffering. But even here, we need to consider the heterogeneous character of white Trump support. And I want to suggest that it has at least three different strands or energies, each of which we need to weigh as we contemplate alternatives to the present. The first is yearning for protection, for stability and order. It's motivated by anxiety and fearfulness. It responded to the strongman, the wall builder, the decider, the enforcer. These are especially the middle-aged white suburbanites. They might be recoverable. The second group that I'll talk about is those who we could say are yearning for disruption and revenge. These are the apocalyptic populace I'll be discussing. They're animated much more by humiliation and rage than by fear. They responded to the boorishness, the bravado, the swagger, the willingness to blow things up without really knowing where the pieces would land. These are, and you know them if you hang out on right-wing websites or look at the comments sections in New York Times articles, these are the thugs, the trolls, the provocateurs, and they will hang on the longest. The third group is the group that's yearning for a fix. It's motivated by socioeconomic frustration. It responded to the promise of tax cuts, of protectionism, of bringing jobs back. These are classic Republicans. There are also many of what we call the swing voters that could have gone another way. Now, all three groups or energies converge on the threat of the demonized immigrant. All three reject globalism and foreignness, so all three can be rallied by the America First sentiment. But there are also non-convergences, investments in different aspects of Trump. Some want order and protection, some want payback, some want restored entitlement, some want a white nation. But if they're not all raging enthusiasts of a plutocratic, authoritarian, racist regime, the question is, can they be recruited into it? By marination in the discourse, by right-wing news and social media, by a single major terror attack, by liberal mockery, by seductions of political libidinal freedom, by the anti-democratic soil tilled by neoliberalism. On the other hand, we have to ask whether they might be recruited for a different future, or whether we can only hope to overwhelm them demographically and strategically. But first, let me say a little bit more about each of these three energies. We'll start with what I'm calling the anxious authoritarians. There's quite a bit of recent social science on those drawn to authoritarian rule. And this social science says that these kinds of people, 100% of whom, when polled, voted for Trump, tells us that they have deeper fears than the rest of the electorate. They're especially anxious about disorder and change. Disorder and change, say, figured by feminism, by queers, by multiculturalism, but also by technology, by finance, by globalization. And they're also anxious about foreignness and threats, figured by ISIS and new immigrants. So they respond to depictions of the world as disordered and dangerous, the specter of drugs and crime and terror and rapid change crashing the gates of their homes or their neighborhoods or their nations or their races or their psyches. They want the law and order, but they also want the strength, the decisiveness, the willingness to use force that Trump campaigned on. Politically and socially, the social science tells us, they prize protection and stability achieved through the exercise of power and hierarchy, and they do not value democratic procedure or institutions. Now, lest you think I've gone over to the dark side of social science, the key question for critical theory when it draws on this kind of social science research is, are these so-called authoritarian personalities hardwired, just waiting to be activated by a leader or a threat? And I want to suggest no, that this idea that they're hardwired is contravened by the fact that in 2011, long before Trump, 44% of US non-college graduates, but only 28% of college graduates approved of having, quote, a strong leader who doesn't need to bother with Congress or elections. You see the same split on abortion and homosexuality. College education literally halves the number who reject these practices as being too upsetting to traditional order and values. Or to approach the matter another way, the number of Americans who think it would be a good idea for the army to rule has doubled over the past two decades. It was 6% two decades ago. It's 12% now. So devotees of authoritarianism are made, not born, and our challenge is to understand how. I'll be talking about that in a moment. Moreover, even the social science acknowledges that non-authoritarians can be scared into authoritarian views. So Trump's brilliance rests right there, stoking the fears that would ramp up the desire for walled security, for eviction of disruption and danger, which he alone would provide through his strong take-no-prisoners personality and politics. And that's why he kept at the dark picture during his campaign, the picture of carnage, invasion, disaster, that so many pundits thought was an over-the-top campaign tactic. The second group, the apocalyptic populace. For the resentful and the humiliated, what I will also call the socially castrated and enraged, fear and danger are not the animating thing. What they seek openly is restored white male entitlement. At least it's political affirmation, even if it can't be materially restored, even if it's all they've got as the world goes to hell. Here, with Make America Great Again, barely masked as Make America White Male Again, Trump converted social and economic castration into a disinhibited grab for that white male entitlement. A grab by the pussy, a grab by the racial slur, by xenophobia, by denigration of the weak, by affirming the poorly educated, by attacking the cosmopolitans and the elite. Trump is tonic for this group's damaged potency and place. He's unreconstructed and unapologetic about the power of his whiteness and wealth and the unbridled rights of his penis. If not ordinary in his billions, he is ordinary in his bluster and boorishness, his impulsive, opinionated, uninformed, and insulting style, his indifference to facts, to evidence, even to consistency. These qualities constitute his lack of qualifications for the presidency, but are what made him every man. They were not irrelevant. They were crucial to his appeal for this group. His style also produced a versatile and far-reaching political personal metaphor, a promise to throw America's weight around as he throws his own, nuking, busting NATO, bringing Mexico and China to heel, bombing ISIS, insulting all who disagreed with him, reviling feminism, multiculturalism, Islam, intellectuals, and policy wonks. Now, the widely noted danger of such conduct in the presidency is irrelevant to the pumping up and potency, restored potency that it signifies. And again, that's why his patent lack of qualifications for the presidency actually worked to his advantage here. To put it sharply, Trump reasserted the entitlement politically and personally to be a bully and a bomb thrower, because bullying and bomb throwing remains the right of white maleness, no matter how little else it has. Importantly, no other configuration of human in the United States, female, brown, black, queer, no other configuration of human could talk or conduct itself this way, especially in politics, without ridicule, profiling, censure, political self-destruction, and probably criminalization and incarceration. But talking and behaving this way actually relicenses it in whites, which relicenses a certain kind of white supremacy. As Trump re-legitimated bellicose white maleness and bellicose Americanness, he also sutured them back together, saying essentially in the classic populist rallying cry, "You alone are the real Americans. Far from forgotten, you are its essence." So again, the liberal head scratching about how Trump's unchecked impulses and ignorance could actually promise order and protection misses how Trump's own disinhibition anointed the wound of castrated white masculinity in the 21st century. And it misses, too, the provocation that Hillary Clinton represented. Well-spoken, smart, knowledgeable, tough, ardently if conventionally feminist, circulating in worlds of power, knowledge, and connection, she was and remains everything this group feels dethroned and castrated by, and it is why they hated her so. All right, so fear and danger for the authoritarians, bullying, bellicosity, and political incorrectness for the resentful and angry white dudes, and then, for the third group, carnage and decline, hemorrhaged jobs, wrecked cities and towns, for that energy emerging from dethroned whiteness that has utter despair over its economic decline and deracination. Clinton ignored that first energy. She revolted the second, and the third was alienated by her basic campaign message. Her message was, "America's already great. We need to keep on the path. There's more to be done. Progress, progress, progress." Now, the progress message aimed at the professional class, at the young, but also at those who were socially and politically recently enfranchised, racial and sexual minorities, the disabled, older women, new immigrants, while felt an actual decline framed Midlands, middle-aged, and older white working and lower middle class experience. So what Clinton's progress and America's already great message did was underscore that population's sense of being dethroned and disdained by new groups and professions, by cosmopolitans, multiculturalists, tech, finance, hipsters, rappers, slender green juicers, and global governance people. All right, so we have an unstable, dangerous, vengeful, know-nothing in the White House because of aging white people freaking out about terror, crime, and immigrants, about fading racial and gender status, and the promise of economic well-being that goes with it, helped along by right-wing media and the wrong Democratic candidate for the Times. But how and why does this take the shape of anti-democratic authoritarianism and license a resurgent plutocracy, a government by and for the rich, especially when that authoritarianism and that plutocracy was not what mobilized or motivated these three energies? Here we need to take a turn toward neoliberalism, understood both as policy, free trade, regressive taxation, deregulation, unbridled capital, leashed labor, diminution of the welfare state, privatized public goods, that's the policy in a quick parentheses, but also understood as a form of rationality. As a form of rationality, what's important about neoliberalism is that not just economic endeavors, but every human activity is cast as properly submitted to market reason, economized in value and conduct. And human beings themselves become responsibilized entrepreneurs of their lives or self-investing bits of human capital. Political, personal, and social relations are rendered by neoliberal reason in market terms, where even learning and exercising and eating and mating become matters of speculative investments, ranked, rated, balanced in your portfolio, hopefully. And where democracy itself, with neoliberal reason, is also devalued and transformed. So, in what way did neoliberal policy and rationality, a global economic order, and a novel order of reason produce or bring about the current regime? Formally, of course, the recent election, like that bringing Brexit about and Theresa May to power, represented a certain rejection of global free trade and free movement of capital and labor, and it represented a rejection both on the left and on the right. And plenty of pundits have declared neoliberalism dead in the aftermath of Brexit and the American election. But here's where we need to be careful. Despite anti-globalization talk coming from the right across the Euro-Atlantic, neoliberal policies of privatization, tax cutting, and deregulation have been put on steroids by the Trump regime. Moreover, Trump's rise from the protectionism to the authoritarianism, from the xenophobia to the NATO knocking, the permanent campaigning to the reduction of politics to deal making is nothing but neoliberalism's effects. And I want to talk about this for just a couple of minutes. Most obvious in this respect are the declining wages, job security, retirement provisions, school quality, and more that has been generated through neoliberal economic policy. Not to mention the fact that America's first ever National Health Care Act, produced under the Obama regime, was so severely compromised by the private interests of providers, pharmaceuticals, hospitals, and insurance companies that it could not deliver affordable access to quality healthcare. Then there's globalization, and here, I think, inchoately, until Trump made it coate, many dethroned American whites imagined a link between the decline of American economic power, the decline of white power, the decline of male earning power, and the decline of nation-state sovereignty, control of its own fate. And I want to suggest that they're right. From offshored union factory jobs and disappearing affordable housing to unprecedented flows of migration and finance and capital, the protected, stable, white, male provider, nation-state sovereignty, and American economic supremacy are all finished. That cannot be reversed, but it can be politically instrumentalized. And that's where the figure of the immigrant was so important, where the Arab Muslim fused with the undocumented Guatemalan or Mexican, where the wall at the southern border of the U.S. merges with the travel ban, where the false promise of good jobs coming back mixes with the false promise of protection from crime and terror. This is where eroded boundaries and barriers, where economic power and security are braided together in a racialized causal logic and braided together in an economic redress. Good deals made by Trump, the deal maker, will replace bad deals. They require a powerful deal maker, a powerful magnate from real estate to take charge. And this is where the implicit promise to make America great again, that promise to whites to make America great again, casts all justice-oriented and all ecologically sustainable concerns as compromising and selling out the nation, just as those whites themselves feel compromised and sold out. In short, what I'm suggesting with neoliberalism here is that if the policy turn is away from international free trade, the reasoning remains neoliberal, the effects remain neoliberal, and we need to dive just a bit deeper into that right now. In addition to casting every activity and every sphere in an economic frame, casting markets and market conduct as appropriate for all human activity and organization, neoliberal reason has a specific antipathy to politics and even to democracy understood as anything more than voting. It treats politics and democracy as bungling at best, fouling markets, and leading toward totalitarianism or the imposition of totalitarian social justice projects at worst. It solicits in the place of politics and democracy a form of statism based on business principles and the support of markets, a statism that will include law and policing, but also a strong measure at times of authority. Now, the point here is not the familiar one, that within neoliberal rationality, what happens is market justice begins to replace social and political justice, and thus legitimates ever greater inequalities and exclusions. That is certainly the case. The point I'm trying to make is a slightly different one, which is that within neoliberal reason, politics is cast as the enemy to freedom, to order, and to progress. Politically organized need provision, politically organized regulation or social planning, all of those, according to Hayek, Friedman, and the ordo-liberals, involve an exercise of concentrated power and hence coercion. That means they restrict liberty and competition and stifle their beneficial effects. So from Hayek to Friedman to the EU technocrats, markets are understood to require protection and promotion and even propping by state institutions or EU institutions, but they do not require intervention in their movements or distributions. And if you get intervention in their movements or distributions, they cannot do their magical work of generating innovation, spontaneous order, progress, and culturing individual freedom and responsibility. Now, this challenge to politics and democracy as distorting and obstructing at best, totalitarian at worst, has sunk very deep into neoliberal cultures. And it's helped, I think, to foment an anti-democratic populist revolt that calls simultaneously for freedom and authoritarianism. Market-style freedom, secured by statist authority to protect, to exclude, to secure as necessary on the basis of business principles and business-like power. In other words, instead of constitutionalism or other democratic institutions, but instead on the basis of orders issuing from business executives and business principals, everything from Muslim bans to torture to indefinite detention to environmental decimation of native lands or indifference to the future of the environment as a whole by withdrawing from agreement, all of that should be handled by executive diktat. Now, apart from executive orders, there's also the notion of deals in this regime. Trump's constant characterization of his predecessors is that they made bad deals. He'll make good ones with China, with Russia, with Europe, with the UN, with Fiat, Ford, with coal, with the states that elected him. In other words, Trump's promise to, as he famously put it, drain the swamp, was not a promise to get Wall Street out of politics. It was a promise to get politics, politicians out of politics. He dismisses as politics judicial checks on his executive orders, congressional resistance to his know-nothing cabinet appointees. He dismisses as politics congressional inquiries and everyday popular protests against him. And in all of this, I want to suggest he's drawing on the neoliberal common sense that politics, including democratic institutions and requirements, interferes with business conduct aimed at securing competitive advantage. All right, so this reproach to politics, this commitment to market liberty, radically deregulated in every sphere, is one important strand of neoliberalism's assault on democracy. Equally important to generating support for plutocratic authoritarianism is what I call neoliberalism's economization of everything, including democratic values, institutions, expectations, and knowledge. The meaning and practice of democracy cannot be submitted to market semiotics and survive. Within neoliberal reason, what happens is freedom becomes reduced to advancing in markets, keeping what one gets, hence legitimating growing inequality. Exclusion is legitimated as strengthening competitiveness. Secrecy is just common sense for business. Popular sovereignty is literally incoherent. It has no place in markets. So citizenship is reduced to voting in what our Supreme Court now routinely calls the political marketplace when talking about democracy. And in that marketplace, voters are treated just as consumers are, analyzed, subsected, targeted, manipulated. They're not educated, not called to think, not called to deliberate, not called to participate. Neoliberalism, of course, also weakens democratic culture through privatizing public goods, making the very notion of concern with the common incoherent. It attacks the notion of social justice as the tyrannical imposition of political norms, where only private liberties and values ought to prevail. And finally, as neoliberalism has privatized our public higher education system, it's restratified access, leaving most of the lower middle and working classes out of access to higher education. And it's transformed what education is for. It's narrowed higher education to job training rather than generating educated democracy. This reminds us that that educational divide that brought Trump to power isn't just a timeless class divide, it's a distinctive neoliberal effect. Taken together, the open neoliberal disparagement of politics, the assault on democratic institutions, values, and imaginaries, the neoliberal attack on public goods, public life, social justice, and an educated citizenry. Taken together, these produce fertile ground for an anti-democratic, anti-egalitarian populism, one that burns on the fuel of those three energies, fear and anxiety, sliding white socioeconomic status, or more blatantly, rancorously wounded whiteness. At the same time, neoliberal common sense permits the Trump regime to press forward with three fundamentals of neoliberalism: deregulation, as that regime takes aim at laws concerning climate change, wilderness protection, labor exploitation, health and safety, equal rights, and the unbridled power of finance. In addition to deregulation, there's privatization. The Trump regime has moved to slash what's left of public funding for the arts, sciences, media, education, provisions for the poor, and of course, healthcare. And then the third neoliberal tier that in addition to deregulation and privatization, tax cuts for business, and tax cuts for the wealthy. All of these are undertaken in the name of enhancing liberty and reducing politics. And again, this anti-politics is not anti-state. Trump is eager to wield the power of the state, but not as a politician, as a tough businessman who will put an end to global handouts and anything else that doesn't prioritize the competitive positioning and protection of the nation. What's in the way? What hamstrings any business? Regulations, procedures, checks and balances, separation of powers, internal opposition or disloyalty, demands for transparency, bad press, all of these are what Trump seeks to dismantle, end run, silence, or lock out. In short, all the principles that make democracy anything at all. This is how a populist revolt, animated and shaped by neoliberalism, has resulted in an anti-democratic, plutocratic authoritarianism. Now, if neoliberalism generated this revolt by decimating livelihoods and neighborhoods, by evacuating and delegitimizing democracy, by eroding national sovereignty, by devaluing knowledge apart from job training and business expertise, this doesn't mean that the political formation taking shape today was actually the one intended by neoliberal intellectuals or policymakers. To the contrary, I would argue, the nationalism, the protectionism, the fusion of corporate, financial, and government power on exhibit in the Trump regime, and the mobilization of hate groups, these are nightmares for neoliberals. Corporocracy, plutocracy, authoritarianism, this is what the neoliberals from Freiburg to Vienna to Chicago were arrayed against. They opposed these things as strongly as they opposed socialism, as strongly as they believed that welfare states and social planning were on the road to socialism. They thought markets propped by carefully formatted state policy would be the antidote not only to socialism, but also to all of these things that we are now witnessing. They dreaded corporate power in political office. They dreaded protectionism and other ways of rigging markets or lashing together economic, political, and social power. There were lots of differences among the original neoliberals, but what binds them together is their commitment to economic liberty, but above all, their commitment to separating political from economic power and diminishing the former in favor of the latter. They were as nervous about rent-seeking plutocrats as they were about Keynesian technocrats. And what they also dreaded, especially Hayek and the ordo-liberals, was political life influenced by the deluded, manipulable masses, the theater in which Trump and other right-wing nationalists are now playing. They thought this too could be prevented by governing rooted in economic principles and shaped as a technocracy. So while I'm suggesting that neoliberalism tilled the soil for anti-democratic, authoritarian, racist populism, that doesn't mean it's neoliberalism's natural telos. It doesn't mean that neoliberalism was all along ethno-nationalist, authoritarian, or plutocratic. Rather, I'm suggesting it's neoliberalism's Frankenstein. On one hand, neoliberalism generated the socioeconomic frustrations, the instabilities, the precarities, the loss of national horizons, the social disintegration that have fomented the nationalism, racism, and demand for authoritarian rule. On the other, I've suggested, neoliberalism generated the hostility to politics, to social justice, and even to democracy in favor of market justice and rationales and heavy statism. And on a third hand, it yielded, Piketty for a moment, capital accumulation that outruns growth, and thus increasing concentrations of capital at the top. And what that resulted in was skyrocketing inequality. 8 men on Earth now have as much wealth as the 3.6 billion humans in the world's poorest half. 6 of those men are white males in the United States. It resulted in skyrocketing inequality, but also in rent-seeking. to replace loss of profit from growth, because you can't grow when you get those concentrations at the top, when capital accumulation outruns growth. And it especially increased rent-seeking in the so-called FIRE sector. That's finance, insurance, and real estate, the world of finance. And that's the sector, of course, that populates Trump's cabinet. Rent-seeking requires political power to enable it, hence requires plutocracy, ruled by the rich for the rich. Otherwise, they can't have the political economy they need. So neoliberalism, I'm suggesting in short, has yielded an unintended spawn, just as Weimar did. I want to conclude. We're obviously witnessing a ferocious eruption of right-wing xenophobic nationalism in almost all Western democracies. And I've been arguing that neoliberal globalization as policy, but also as a form of reason, governing reason, has been important in organizing the character of this right-wing xenophobic nationalism. It's produced a reaction against the declining power and significance of the nation-state as an economic container or actor and as a site of homogeneous identity. It's produced, I'm suggesting, especially in the United States, but I think not only so, a furious death rattle of white male rule and entitlement at a cultural, social, economic, and political level. It's produced a populist roar against politics and politicians, not so much against elites, which is why it's not conventional populism. It's produced also the fear of precarity and volatility and terror in a world increasingly dominated by finance, rocked by violence, but controlled by no one. It's produced the challenges of an unprecedented 65 million human beings displaced from other parts of the world, seeking refuge wherever they can. And then there's the exploitation of all of the above by politically ambitious, economically powerful forces who keep this rebellion from turning either anti-capitalist or radically democratic. And that leaves us with a group of questions. I'll just state them briefly. First, what are the dangers of preserving what I would call now the shell of electoral democracy when so much that makes popular rule and democratic institutions viable is now in tatters? Second, how do we address something I've barely spoken about, the deep but unavowed nihilism and despair of our time? A nihilism that has been growing for a couple of centuries, as Nietzsche promised, abetted by neoliberal reason, a nihilism that makes truth and reason into a plaything, that makes values fungible, that vitiates conscience and felt responsibility for the present or for the future by the powerful and the powerless alike. Not only a nihilism, but also a despair about what? That the political and economic and ecological catastrophes contouring our time have issued from this species of ours, this unique capacity that we have to think, to create, to speak, to inhabit complexity, but also to organize violence and cover the earth with our refuse and detritus. And the question here, the despair here, is can this possibly be redeemed by a more sustainable, just, and humane order of things? And I think there's a great deal of despair about that question. What's to be done with this nihilism and this despair? How do we address the third question, the apocalyptic dimension of contemporary populism? More than angry and frustrated, more than wanting a fix, apocalyptic populism is really willing to blow things up without a plan. It's openly expressed by, for example, those Brexiters who said, I know Brexit will take us over a cliff, but this is insufferable. Or those Trump supporters who said, yeah, he probably will destroy the world. Or, I know he can't run the country, but what the hell? There's nihilism and despair here, but it's compounded by another inchoate recognition that the future, if there is one, does involve what I keep reminding us is an end to white male rule. Some in this long-ruling minority seem willing to take the world down as it goes down. And my final question, the one we're all working with these days, how to advance in this context left aims, modest egalitarianism, relief of gross injustices, violence, and suffering. The prospect, again, of self-governing and developing a sustainable democratic mode of production and consumption. These aims comport very poorly with neoliberal reason and the nihilism that it expresses. They're dismissed as political goals by centrists and rightists, by realists as well as authoritarians. They do entail the end of a long history in which whiteness is an immense entitlement and power. But they're also difficult. They're difficult to bring about on a global scale. They're intensely vulnerable when they're organized locally. They need to be both global and local. It's very hard to figure out space, place, and articulation here. Indeed, never in human history has the deep transformation of social, political, and economic arrangements seemed more challenged, more complex, more remote, and yet more essential to securing a future for this planet and all life on it. So, the question is whether and how the centrist willingness to accommodate existing arrangements or the apocalyptic impulse to blow up the future might be converted, might be recruited into another order of desire. The question is whether the nihilism resulting from the death of God might be converted to an appreciation that the world really is in our hands, a recognition that values really are chosen, they are not given from some deep fundament or from on high. Governing truths really are constructed, and we therefore better construct them thoughtfully and well. Whether we can handle the recognition that capitalism, like state communism, may have run its course, and its increasing domination by finance today is possibly final proof of its incompatibility with need provision and ecological sustainability. There is also the importance of whether we can sustain the recognition that democracy cannot be abandoned just because it never realized its promise. Because if we abandon it, then we abandon all hope of freedom and equality conjoined. We also must sustain the recognition that resilience is no substitute for justice or sustainability, that the earth is tender and must be cared for as such. Kindling recognition of these things and desire for them on the part of many is our only hope. It's a very slim one, but it seems to me the world is quite literally at stake. Thank you.